I'm Debbie Travis.
And I'm Tommy Smythe.
And this is Trust Me, I'm a Decorator. Today's guest is a best-selling author and beloved home cook and the host of a new daytime television show called The Good Stuff.
Today we have the wonderful, the amazing, the inimitable, and the unsinkable Mary Berg.
Hello. Oh my gosh, I never thought I'd be like lightly compared to Molly Brown. Thank you.
How are you, Mary?
Hi, how are you?
We're great. And we're so happy to have you with us. What a year. Like, it has been an incredible journey for you. Your star, which was already so on the rise, has now gone totally supernova with a brand new show on daytime television and a new book that is just out. Tell us a little bit first about the book.
So the book, it's my third cookbook, which is pretty wild to think about. Even if I go back in time, if I were to tell 12-year-old me who was learning how to cook through reading cookbooks and stuff, that I would have one, let alone three, is pretty amazing. But it's my third cookbook. It's called In Mary's Kitchen. It's the first cookbook that I fully wrote, shot, cooked, styled, did everything in my actual home kitchen.
This is like the cookbook version of Whole Foods. It's non-processed.
Yeah. 100%. It's very like kitchen to photograph, like farm to table. Mm-hmm. Much to the, I think, benefit of my neighbors and family shot the cookbook here because there was so much food getting pumped out of this kitchen. But I'm in a Toronto semi, so fitting it all in and getting it done was truly a feat. But it's probably my most approachable book yet. I found as I have continued to write books and write recipes for anything from, again, books to shows, I keep trying to think about what people at home are actually going to make, not what like you want to pretend you're going to make. You know what
yes,
I mean?
Yes, there's aspirational cooking, and then there's actually, I have 10 minutes to get dinner together cooking.
Exactly. And I love the aspirational thing. It's great. I think I used to be more into that, though. But after, like, especially the last few years, when we were only allowed to shop every 2 weeks and everything like that, I'm just more kind of realistic with the way I write my recipes. I'm a little more like, I just want people to cook it.
Yeah.
I just want them to make the food and to enjoy it and not kind of feel like they're pulling their hair out at the end of it because it doesn't look exactly like the picture. So I'm really proud of it. I'm very excited.
Are the ingredients simple or do you go very in depth? Because that's, I think, what scares people.
100%. I go simple because I'm a pantry cook. Like I love going into my pantry and being able to make stuff. I call it apocalypse cooking. Like if there were an apocalypse, I can't run. I'm not good at like anything athletic, but I could cook. I could make something out of nothing. So that's kind of how I write my recipes. And if I do, if there are a couple recipes here and there where I ask you to buy something that maybe you don't have, I give you a tip or a trick on how to use that ingredient elsewhere. Because I hate it when you're making a recipe, you use 2 teaspoons of something and then it just sits in your fridge for God knows how long, hiding away there, becoming something else.
Do you think it's a female thing though, that, you know, in my, I live with a lot of men. And so, you know, they'll open the fridge and go, well, there's nothing here. I can open the fridge and I'll see, you know, one onion with green bix sprouting out, an old bit of chickpeas, an old bit of this, and I'll think, yeah, there's a full course meal. I could do that.
100%. I think it is. I grew up with a brother who still, to this day, when he comes over, he's like a fridge opener. You know, those people who just like immediately, without any reason, just will go open the fridge and look and see what's going on, but find nothing. I 100% think it is. I find that a challenge. Anytime someone says, I have nothing to eat.
Hang on a minute. There's an egg. There's a... I think you're right. It's the apocalypse. It's kind of the war mentality. I would have loved to have been born in the times of rationing and stuff. I mean, yeah, what I could do with one egg and one leaf and, you know, sneaking around the corner because he's getting leeks from somebody's garden or, you know, stealing apples or, you know.
I love that Debbie's apocalypse cooking includes theft.
Of course. I mean, that's all part of the fun of it.
If you're not making from someone's garden, then you're not doing it right.
It also tastes better. If you've stolen something, even if it's off somebody else's plate, even if you've nicked the last strawberry off your brother's plate, he may be becoming, it always tastes better than the strawberry that your mum gave you.
I 100% agree. You're like, there's a little bit of like risk to this strawberry, which is very fun.
Well, it's like Halloween candy. Would you ever buy that stuff in the shop? I used to, you know, my kids would keep it because they were so mean. You know, they would hide it from me, all those little miniature Mars bars and Snicker bars and stuff like that. And then I would spend hours at home trying to find their candy. And God, it was good because it was stolen off my children.
This is like the opposite of most people. I think most people hide the candy on their children. But your kids did it the opposite way. I love that.
This conversation has gone sideways way faster than
sorry,
I thought.
Oh, sorry, Tommy. My fault.
So I want to say, I think, and I could be wrong about this, but I think that the last time all three of us were together, were we not doing an on-camera segment for the Marilyn Dennis show where we judged dinner party contestants? Is that not right? Yeah. Do you remember that, Debbie? Where we had different people create a little dinner party. For you, me, and Mary. And then we had to decide who did the best dinner party. Do you remember that?
I remember it because I don't remember what it was for or what we were doing. But I just remember there was a lot of delays. And I think we ate the food. And I remember the producer coming over saying, but where's the food? I haven't shot the segment yet. We've been sitting here for 9 hours and we'd eaten all the props.
Well, we were starving.
I remember also, Debbie, one thing I remember very vividly. There were these like cucumber smoked salmon roll-ups that were like supposed to be like a little hors d'oeuvre, like a one-biter, yeah. But they were like the size of a softball, yeah. And you popped it right in.
They were huge.
Yeah, and I think things were starting to wilt and smell, and it was very, we were in a tiny space, weren't we? It was like a crew of 10 and us, and your hair's wilting. The smell in there must have been dreadful. The food's going off. And
it was years ago. And the last time that Mary and I were on camera together, it was St. Patrick's Day, right before the lockdown, 2 days before we were locked in our homes for 2 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember that because we, hilariously, with our sweet summer child brains, we all had a beer and everyone was very like, don't share glasses. Yeah. And that was the big thing. Meanwhile, we're like yelling in each other's faces. Oh,
we were right next to each other. We were in a cluster of people trying to recreate the atmosphere of an Irish pub on St. Patrick's Day. And there was no audience already, I don't think. I think the audience had already left the building. And it was literally the last time that people were in studio for like 2 years. And I always tell this story that like, I had one last toast with Mary Berg, and then we went off to our houses and stayed there for 2 years.
Yeah. Honestly, good send-off.
We raised a glass of Guinness and then went home for 2 years.
And then we went home and we never left again. Yeah.
I think, Mary, you and I came on as a guest on your cooking show.
Yes. This was a cooking show back in, I think, like 2016, maybe, or 2017. Yeah.
Because I remember it was in a house. It wasn't your house, right? It was a rental house.
No.
Because I remember a woman sobbing in the living room. And I remember going in and I said, who are you? And between kind of snotty sobs, she said, I'm the homeowner. I didn't know it was going to be like this. Cables and cameramen and, you know, whatever. She said, I thought it was only going to take 5 minutes. I said, are you kidding? Never in television is it going to take 5 minutes. And she was like besides herself. She was like, I'll never do this again.
A public service announcement to anyone thinking of shooting a show or allowing a show to be shot in their home, it is a longer haul than you think. Like with my current cooking show, Mary Makes It Easy, we shoot that in my home. And everyone's always like, my neighbors, how many episodes do you shoot a day? And you're like, maybe what?
If we're
like,
lucky. Yeah, if we're lucky.
Well, I remember somebody walking up to me once. Actually, it was a relative. She's buried in the garden now. But anyway, she said to me, oh, I think my show, I don't know which one it was, but it was an hour. And then she said, what do you do for the rest of the day?
Oh, my God. So she thought it was shot in real time.
So I hacked her to death. But I mean, like, really? Really? You know, I mean, no clue. But so is the other cooking show going on? You're still doing that?
Yeah. So I've had a couple iterations of the cooking show. That was kind of the like beta test zone. Then I had a show called Mary's Kitchen Crush, which was shot in a studio with like a set built to look like my house, very much not my house. It was this like vast, beautiful, like no ceiling room. And then now we have Mary Makes It Easy, which just the third season premiered a weeks ago. Actually, it premiered the same day as The Good Stuff, which was a busy day. New episodes just started airing also on Food Network in the States. So it's like that one sells around the world. It's really fun. It's really strange thinking about the fact that like my little kitchen, my little shotgun kitchen is just around the world.
I know. It's so intimate. But it also, I think, is the secret sort of magic of the Mary Berg thing. I hate calling things a brand because people are not brands, they're people. But the thing that you do, the magic that you bring, I think is that kind of like come into my own home, look at the food that I make for my own friends and family, be with me as my authentic self. So that's a great segue for me to lead us into The Good Stuff.
Yeah.
I think what I want to know, because I haven't seen you since it premiered. First of all, the show is beautiful. It is authentic. It's different than other kinds of shows in its genre. So I think that kudos are due in terms of the crew that put it together, the producers that put it together with you, the way that it was crafted around you. Because again, that's the magic is Mary Berg. But I want to know from you, like, what was it like to transition from lifestyle television, which is very prescribed and very, it can be a lengthy process. You have time, you get do-overs, to going into this kind of format. Like, what was it really like? Because I know you have the holy shit moment of like, oh my God, I have my own daytime TV show, but then you have to go and do it.
Honestly, I still haven't like fully leaned into the like, holy smokes, this is happening. I'm still like a little kind of floating, not above it all, but it feels very...
like an out-of-body experience?
Yeah, it's very, like, I don't know if I've just... I said to my husband the other day, I was like, I feel like I should go talk to someone because I feel like I'm compartmentalizing really well. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Maybe.
Like, I, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, I'm feeling great, but maybe this is the best time to go and be like, is she okay? Are we good? It's good to check in. I love it. Like you said, the crew, the producers, the camera, everyone from even set design and everything came with so much experience because they worked with you both. They worked with the Marilyn Dennis show for years. So getting to kind of come in and be the new guy on set with this crew of people who know exactly what they're doing. They are experts in their field. Definitely felt like I had safety net after safety net after safety net underneath me with like rigging. So I didn't ever feel like I was going to fall or fail or anything like that. But it is really intimidating. I think the thing that's the strangest for me, and I know Debbie, you've done daytime TV so much, but you've also, again, and same Tommy, you've both done that lifestyle segment where you shoot something and then months go by and then it comes out.
Yeah.
You almost have an immediate reaction to what people are thinking and feeling with a live audience.
That's an adjustment, I imagine.
It's really a huge adjustment, but it's also really nice because you kind of immediately get like, this is not working, or
lot of courage as well, I think, to step into a slot that has been so solid for so long. And in fact, this morning I was chatting with Marilyn actually about, she's coming to see me next week in Italy. And we're talking about, you know, how many pairs of knickers she needs, you know. No, we're talking about what to bring, what's the weather like.
She asked me and I was like, I don't know how many.
That was me. I mean, I don't know if this is just a lady thing again, but like when even if I'm going away for a weekend, I bring like 20 pairs.
Yeah.
I'm like, God, I don't know why.
I think it's because traveler's diarrhea is a real thing.
Oh, Tommy. You see, it's what happens when you have a bloke on. But we were just talking about packing and weather and things like that. And I told you we were going to be talking to you in a minute. And she said, it takes a lot of guts, you know. And I think she's right. You know, it does. And you're right. We all know that crew very well. So did a lot of them go over? Is it a lot of the same people that we would know?
It's pretty much 100% the same people.
Okay, great.
A couple of segment producers who... I believe went from full-time to freelance, have now gone on to other things.
It's the same studio, right?
Yeah, same studio, same. We've got every day I walk in and I see the plaque. It's Marilyn's studio, which is so amazing. And getting to be in that space and feeling like, I'm not much of like an energy person, but feeling the energy in that room is really, really amazing. Understanding that like, even the set design, we actually made it so there's this kind of filigree on the wall, but you can still see through to that brick wall that's just so like iconic of the Marilyn Dennis set.
Yeah.
Which is really amazing. And it is same cameras, same crew, same floor director.
It's like a family because they are so incredibly kind. I remember when I used to go on the Oprah show, they were very similar. Like you think I'm absolutely nothing, you know, Tom Hanks is sitting in the next room, but they treated everybody with such enthusiasm and oh my God. And I remember flying from Chicago, from the Harpo Studios to a tiny regional show somewhere in Canada in like Saskatoon or something, and was met by some pimply 16-year-old who was with a clipboard going, and you are, right, you know, like so disinterested. Yeah. So the thing is that if you treat people, you know, that you're honored to have them there because they know you're nervous, they're thrilled seeing what you're going to be teaching people. We've all had, you know, directors and cameramen who were sitting on their phones or reading a book. I had a makeup artist who was reading a book once while she was doing my makeup. You know, I've even had the cigarette hanging out in the corner of the mouth. In Japan, I once had a guy smoking as he did my makeup, you know, and he would put the cigarette behind his ear. And I'm like, things have changed, I know, a lot. But when you make somebody feel special, you're going to give a better performance and then everybody gains. They don't want you to give a bad, you know, because you say energy, it's, you know, it doesn't matter. They can do their job 100%, but it's all comes down to you. Those eyeballs, I don't mean to make you nervous, but those eyeballs are on you, nobody else. And it doesn't matter if what you're cooking doesn't work. And I think that's what I learned in television at the beginning. Doesn't really matter if the wall looks like shit because they're looking for the commentary. Yeah. They're looking for the humanity behind it. And we have this fabulous, drop-dead, gorgeous chef in Italy who does our retreats. And I brought him over just before COVID. And he came on the Marilyn Dennis show, but he's not a television person. And he wanted to teach making your own pasta, making the dough. And then he had this little machine that you put the pasta through. And of course, Marilyn's there. And they asked me to go on with him just to kind of, you know, hold his hand. I was like holding his pants, you know. And he's, Tommy knows him. He is a god. He is gorgeous. Absolutely stunning. So it doesn't matter. Well, his pasta went all wrong. The machine got clogged, the whole thing. And I could see it. And, you know, you can't be pulling those angry faces on television. So Marilyn and I just jumped in, you know, this poor rookie, and made fun of it, you know, whatever. And I mean, he was sobbing when he came out of there. He's Italian. He didn't want to fail, you know. But it doesn't matter. They want to see your pearly smile and they want to see you having a good time. So yeah, so it's all on you, kiddo.
You're totally right. I think there's like with that crew, and something that like I saw obviously Marilyn do and something that I want to continue, there's like a kindness and respect for everybody and the skills that they have. Like I am flummoxed by microphones and camera. Like, I cannot do these things. And getting to work with people who are so good at something that I have absolutely no skill set at is fascinating and amazing. And actually, one of the things I tell anytime we have a new expert on, someone who's either never done TV before or is nervous or whatever, I whisper to them right before, I'm like, nobody knows. Nobody knows if you forgot cumin. Nobody knows if you messed up or if you say the wrong thing. I might know, you might know, but no one else does. And it's the little secret. And honestly, when things went wrong, I think I almost burnt down that studio making real because everybody makes mistakes.
I think it's important to note too, because I've had a chance to tune in and see the show, that with the inevitable comparisons and with the same crew behind the scenes and all those things that are similar, the amazing thing about the show, I think its greatest achievement is that it actually manages to be completely different than any other show within that genre that's ever been done in Canada. And I think that is, again, as I said earlier, a testament to everyone involved on the show. But also, I so admired that there was no attempt to replace Marilyn Dennis in that slot. Marilyn was so supportive. I mean, I can tell you because I know from private conversations that I've had with Mare that she was incredibly supportive of your transition into the time slot. But even she kept saying, you know, it's not going to be a show like mine. It's going to be a very different show. And then when I watched it and saw that that was made real by all of the people involved in making sure that it was, I was really delighted for you because, you know, comparisons are difficult and there is no comparison.
How could you walk in, like, there? If anyone even, like, attempted to walk into that time slot and basically make the same show, you would be making inherently a worse show. Yeah. Like, it was it's such a canon. It's such an amazing show that meant so much to so many people, present company included. There was no way. It's true, even though you have the same crew. And again, everybody worked so hard to make sure it had its own identity.
Yeah. And it comes through. It really does. The authenticity of that really comes through in the show. And that was what I was so excited about because everyone is rooting for you. I know that the show, because I have secret spies, has been incredibly successful since the launch and that it's doing incredibly well. And I just want to have this quick opportunity to congratulate you on that, Mary, because like Debbie said, you know, it is on you. And that's a lot to put on those beautiful little shoulders of yours. You know?
Yeah, it's like, you know, when you've got a favorite book, like you love this book and then they turn it mm-hmm. into a movie. And mm-hmm. that actress or actor has to take those characters that they know are beloved, that every single person who's ever read that bestseller has that image of that person. And it does slap mm-hmm. you sometimes because it's so rare that you read a great book and then on the screen is somebody else. It's not what was in your head. And they have a different voice. They have everything's different. But within a few minutes, you start to fold, if the film is as good as the book, you start to fold into it. Whereas, you know, that's going to happen to you because, yeah, the first few weeks people will hold on. Well, you know, whatever it's, you know, but you have to fold it in and going, I'm just doing my thing.
Yeah. And doing it so well, really doing it so well.
Thank you. I refer to myself as like on set, we talk about this a lot because like, you're right, Debbie and Tommy, like I'm the only person people are seeing, me and an expert or just me or whatever. But behind me, there's a producer who's done weeks of work on the segment. There's other people who are working hard. There's a camera, there's sound, there's
an army of people.
Lighting. And I'm just like, I always say, I'm like, even when I do Mary Makes It Easy, even when with cookbooks and stuff, again, I'm the main face you're seeing, but I'm like the loon on a loony. I don't actually like give it any value necessarily, but I'm just the face that you see that you associate with the thing.
We're just going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
This episode sponsored by BetterHelp.
Debbie, wouldn't you say that time is one of our most important resources?
Tommy, I just wish I had unlimited time for my family and friends. Don't you find the days are just flying by?
But it's true that you make what's important to you a priority. And when we think about relationships, we can't forget about our relationship with ourselves.
You know, we all have ups and downs, and sometimes the downs can be quite tough. And another ear can be so important. And sometimes it's even better if it's somebody who's not a personal friend or a relative. So I think it's good to talk to somebody else.
And with therapy, you can learn positive coping skills, how to set boundaries, and it empowers you to be the best version of yourself.
Give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and work with your schedule.
Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp.
Visit betterhelp.com/decorator to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/decorator.
A big part of design and decoration for us, and everyone really, is putting your memories on display. When my children went away to camp, it was the first time we'd kind of not been together, and they both wrote me letters, and they were probably 8 and 9 years old, and they are the funniest letters, and I framed them, put them up on the wall, and I see them every day, and sometimes if I feel a bit down, I just read those letters, mostly asking me for more candy, but I think framing a letter is a wonderful thing.
That is why we love the idea of Framebridge. They honestly make it so easy to get anything framed, and they're really, truly affordable.
It's easy to do in person at one of their 20 Framebridge retail stores, and
it's so easy to order online at framebridge.com.
You just upload a photo for them to print. Picking the frame was really easy, but also really hard because there were so many options. I went for walnut, which is a solid walnut frame, but I think next time I'll go for Florence. And they'll mail it to you using their free, secure, prepaid packaging service.
Framebridge has been trusted to frame millions of our memories.
Visit framebridge.com or a local Framebridge store. You can custom frame just about anything. Again, that's framebridge.com.
I wonder, since you have been in the saddle now on that show for some time, has there been anything that's been like a big surprise for you? Like a segment that really hit that you were just like, wow, that really worked. What's the highlight reel so far?
I think for me, like obviously I love cooking and getting in that kitchen is so much fun and having other people come in. I've got like a couple, I love having my mom part of it. My mom is a
carer. I know.
Like she
she's poised to become her own big star.
I am but a conduit to the genius of my room. I know that. I'm fully aware. She does the same. She waltzes in and it's just like hilarious and is like, what did I do? And just steals the show every time. She's excellent. So getting to do stuff with her has been so amazing and wonderful. But also, I never really thought of myself as like an interviewer or anything like that. And getting the chance to sit down with people from all different walks of life, whether they're just like everyday Canadians doing something great in their community or amazing authors. We had an author on, Rowan Jenny Knox, who just had a book come out. And right before publication, their publisher actually pushed the publication date because right before publication, he came out as a trans man. So the novel or the book, rather, the memoir is the name that he used to go by. So there was this time where they had to like do some press and things like that so he could actually be fully himself, and getting to talk to him. And his book is heavy. It's a memoir based on trauma and growth, but the key to his story is like, isn't it amazing that people can go through all these things and just be their true person? And it's amazing. And then also like doing interviews with, I got one coming out, I think this week, chatting with Tim McGraw or Andre Amazing. DeGrasse, who at first are a little maybe reserved, and then they just, watching them open up in the span of a 4-minute conversation is like so engaging and thrilling for me.
It is a real high when you can unlock the key with somebody. I mean, I haven't done a lot of interview format stuff. Debbie, you've been thrust into that role before. What are your thoughts on the whole going from lifestyle and doing what you do to going into like interviewing somebody? You've done some big ones.
I think it's incredibly difficult because, you know, they all, you know, they all kind of merge now. You know, you've got to have many talents today to be on telly. And, you know, most of us came out and you were a cook and you did this well and the camera liked you. And then that, you know, me, I was a painter, camera liked me, did it. Yeah. But then it gets into the interview stage. And I think the one thing, you know, you need to be is a good listener, which I am not. And I kind of rather not talk about myself. Just kidding. But the very first interview I ever did was in a hardware. It was in the very, very, I was probably your age, early days, and I was in a hardware store in a place called Peterborough, like a really dodgy, you know, local hardware.
We know what a place called Peterborough is.
That shows how low I was, because my first interviewer was the guy who stacked the shelves. I wasn't interviewing, you know, Paul McCartney. I know it was the guy who stacked the shelves in the hardware store. But I was talking to him about brushes and stuff like this, because this is what I did. It's really the early days. My poor husband Hans directed me, as you were saying. It's not just the people behind the scenes; it's the poor family as well. And he directed me, and I remember him standing.
He still does.
He still does. So we had this list of questions, like, you know, when you finish painting, do you wrap your brush in newspaper, or do you put it into water, or do you put it into, you know, all these kind of questions that on my show was quite interesting. So this poor guy, this rural guy standing there going, what the camera's everywhere. We did this for like 25 minutes and I turn around and I see Hans's livid face and he goes, but you haven't let him answer a question. You've answered every single one. Because it's like, because I do this. So I realized early on that I was not a good interviewer. And I've had to really pinch myself sometimes when Toby and I started the podcast, because we'd never done podcasts before. Because sometimes we were driving back from a party a few weeks ago and I listened, because I can't listen to myself. I never watch. And I'm thinking, Tommy never spoke. So sometimes I have to say, pull back, pull back, pull back. And also, I think a good interview, if you watch great interviewers, it's a fine line. Because when you see a bad interview, it really stands out like a sore thumb, doesn't it? And I'm talking as a viewer. But you have to be ready with the next question. But you also have to be interested. So I remember seeing somebody quite famous who I never thought was a very good interviewer. And she said something like, so, you know, how did you feel, you know, when your husband was killed in the accident? And he was answering, and then she said something like, and what did you have for breakfast? You know, so it was like there was no reaction because she wasn't taking in the answers. You know what I mean?
She wasn't listening.
Yeah. That is the talent, because your brain is doing the two things at once, being interested and enjoying it. And a good interviewer, often like Tommy and I, always go off script. We have no script. We just go off whatever we're talking about, because yeah. I love the bouncing around. But on a formal, very big interview on television, you have to have a bit of
structure. But in my mind, it's always what I'm learning is it is a combination of, because sometimes also you'll ask one question and in their answer, they'll answer the next three questions. So now you've got, or you're going to go to question six and put it here because it fits better. And then you're doing it all out of order. But it's fun. It's kind of like mental gymnastics where you get to jump around. And then sometimes a producer will be like, in the pack, we're going to talk about pigeons. But the conversation, it's not coming up naturally. So in your mind, you have to be like, okay, so producer is going to be mad if I drop this pigeon question, because it's going to be like, what did you have for breakfast after talking about the serious thing?
I had squab.
So I find that. Yeah, exactly. I call it squab. No big deal. But Debbie, you're so amazing at, like, you've done things that truly would absolutely terrify me, like doing commentary.
Oh my God, the royal wedding. Yeah, I mean,
that was nerve wracking, and I like them. It's like writing for me because it takes me out of my comfort zone. When Tommy and I started the podcast, it was because we did the lives on Instagram, and it was just like, okay, sure, I'll take my pajamas off. It was during COVID. Put something on, and we burbled away for an hour about what we were doing, and people must have been thinking, bloody hell, it's like a train wreck. You know? It's like, but we had so much fun. And I think when you're having fun, people have it, but that's okay for Instagram, but it's not okay if you're a bit more structured. But that year, I did both the royal wedding and I did the 50th anniversary of Coronation Street, but that was filmed. But that was a lot of interviews. Like, we went to Manchester, where I'm from. And
did your Manchester accent come back?
Talking like that before I finish, like, hello. And you know, we interview, it's coming back now already, just talking about it. But you know, and you see your stars, you're seeing people that you've grown up with. I mean, it's been on air for 50 years. And I found it so hard to pull it together, to just really, and I had a great hair and always be great to your hair and makeup artist, because they're more than that. They're your right hand. They're holding you up. They're going, saying it's okay. They're making sure that you don't have to worry about, you got, you know, lipstick on your teeth or something. But she was fabulous, and she was, they brought her in from Manchester, and she just, you know, was pumping me the whole time. And in the end, I just became myself and tried not to be too gaga about it. But that was taped, so you can do it over and over again. But you don't. The thing is, when you interview somebody famous, you can't be the naive one. You know, you can't. They can't be keep doing it again because the interviewer is fluffing her lines, right? It doesn't look very professional. But when I did the royal wedding, it was like being on crack cocaine. Not that I've had any since yesterday, but it's like, you know, you are on a high that I will never ever forget. And the mistake, so there was Cheryl Hickey, me, and two very well-known, very, you know, professional journalists from CTV or Global, I can't remember, but anyway, so they're all sitting there and you've got the camera on you, and you were all given you were all given an iPad, and it was the early days of all that stuff, because nobody knew what was going on in the Westminster Abbey, and who, you knew who Elton John was, but everybody else, it's like, oh, and there goes Lord, and you're looking down at your your iPad going, there goes Lord so-and-so, and with his three children, you know, Tilly, Billy, Willy, you know, and then there was the dress. So nobody in the world knew the designer of the dress. And we had the I think the names of who it could possibly be. And as Kate walked out of that abbey, it flashed up. And she's wearing Alexander McQueen, you know, and I got to do it. And I was like, because, you know, I could have got it wrong and said Marks and Spencer's.
I don't think you would have.
She's in Tommy Hilfiger. To me now, those are the things that give me the thrill, you know, and you're out of your comfort zone now. And every core of your body is, I don't think you're worrying about if you get it right. You're just like, I'm doing it, I'm doing it, I'm doing it, you know.
For me, it's I like my big not so secret is I'm ever since I was a little kid, I hate reading out loud. I think it's because they always put me in like in high school and elementary school, I was always behind Tyler and he was the fastest, best reader. And then I'd be like terrified. And now every day with the open of the show and with the open of each segment and stuff, everything else is kind of riffing, but I'm reading a teleprompter. So every day I have to turn off. My mouth goes dry. I had to turn off the voice in my head saying, you don't know how to read.
Which, like, of course you do. You've written books.
it's the fear of that. But I don't know. I like trying things and I like pushing. And I like, I think trying new stuff is kind of the point of life and the point of kind of getting up in the morning.
I think with a teleprompter, I think it's very hard for everybody because everybody's waiting for you. It's time, you know, and it's like time and everything. But once you're standing there doing your thing, and I've worked with so many amazing hosts and presenters and stuff, I mean, worldwide, and you know the good ones because it's as if you're plugged in and you must find that it's like a spark goes through your body. And it's like, and I used to go on with Marilyn, and because I know her so well and we've, you know, we know each other as friends, and I try and rein it in, but you end up talking about the most ridiculous things. And when you're plugged in, let Mary go, just go Mary, you know? And I think that's the wonder of it. And that's the wonder of the relationship between you and the viewer.
And it's the same with both of you. Every time I've watched, Tommy, any show you've done, whether like it's Where To I Do, or even just seeing you online, like you're even when I see your posts from like your design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from Tom, yeah.
I feel like you there.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
I lost my mind. That kitchen you recently did with the banquette and the peninsula and that, obsessed. Like but I feel you because I think that's the thing. You develop a relationship with whether it's your viewers or your followers or whatever, where you can see that personality. And I think that's the thing that makes things
relatable. Maybe it's just relatability.
Yeah.
You know, I think at the end of the day, I know a lot of people who lead somewhat public lives or work in the media. And all of us here do that to some degree or another, varying degrees. I think we all have one thing in common, and that is a compulsion to share. And the sharing and the exchange that you have with an audience of any kind, whether it's a social media audience or a podcast audience or a television audience, is a huge gift that, you know, I think everybody who's successful at this honors that gift. And I want to say, like, before we part ways, because I know you have other things to get to. You're the busiest woman in Canadian television right now with two shows and a new book out. I wanted to bring it back to food because we started talking about your book earlier. And, you know, what I'm always interested in is, you know, like, what's the future of food? And I want to remind our listeners that Mary Berg is, you know, now a newly minted, wildly successful talk show host, but she also is a very serious food person who knows a great deal about the culinary arts and as well is interested in food and food systems. So how do you feel about the future of food? What are we looking at, you know, in the future?
Honestly, I think the main thing that I'm in my don't yuck someone's yum era. Like, I'm really trying to be like, you do you, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think there's so much, especially as a person who grew up, when I grew up or before, I think there's so much shame with respect to food.
I see that.
Yeah. And whether it's what you like or how you eat or And as like a female person in the public sphere, not looking at it just as energy and something that nourishes you, but also something that can like, you know, like impact your physicality and things. I don't think that should be a thing. And I understand people have medical reasons why they need to eat certain ways and everything like that. And I'm not saying that. But at the end of every segment or every act of my cooking show, and at the end of every cooking segment on The Good Stuff, I make a point to take a big old bite. Because I think seeing a person, let alone a person who presents as meat, dig in, like with just kind of like abandon, it's kind of nice. It's kind of refreshing. It kind of gives permission to anybody to just like enjoy it. Food is something that should nourish you and make you feel good and better from every single part of it, whether it's shopping for it, making it, eating it. Like everything should, except for dishes. Dishes suck. No one's going to make those better. But like, but I think it's, we live in a time where food is getting more expensive. There are so many different kind of things to think about. There's so many socioeconomic things to do with food as well.
A lot of mixed messaging as well with regard to what's healthy and what isn't.
That's the big one. And it is so infuriating. There are so many people who purport themselves to be experts in so many different fields online. And we live in the age of information where literally you can find like research or whatever. And sometimes it is done by someone with letters behind their name that supports what you feel. And that's fine and dandy. But when there's just people on TikTok being like, you see this ingredient, this is poison. And it's like, but it's not. And a lot of times there, when people are disparaging foods, they're disparaging foods that are more affordable. And that's like, that is not okay. Like that's a way of, again, kind of creating this kind of like structure, this hierarchy of like what's good, what's bad. And I just don't think that's a thing.
Maybe the future is, and the young people who hopefully are doing more about food in schools, be their own warriors. Mm. Because you're right, there's first of all, most of the all you have to do is look at those people on the internet and see what they're selling first. You know, you need to learn your own body. You need to know what doesn't make you feel so good, what makes you feel so good. And sometimes it's okay to say, okay, well, this doesn't make me good, feel so good. But don't necessarily go running from it. So I know if I drink too much, I don't feel very good. And, you know, then you have this heavy social life, but I wouldn't give that up. But then I'll say, okay, now I'm going to do 3 months of being really careful, really good. And it's all about balance, bringing that balance in. But I think the good side of everything that's, you know, out there is information. There's kind of no excuse. There's a lot of noise, as you say, but there's no excuse anymore for anybody. You can Google everything and start working it out.
And I think it's the same as I have this thing that I use with business, with life, and I call it my wibble. And it like happens right here in my kind of tummy. And it's basically like a silly word for like intuition, intuitive eating. Like eat what makes you feel good. Like I eat fish. I don't eat pork, beef, everything like that, but I cook it and I don't have issues with other people eating it. I cook it all the time, but it just doesn't make me feel as good as something else. Like, and every once in a while, I'll just realize I'm like, oh, I need protein because my body is like, you want to eat a can of tuna, like you, or you need to go eat some chickpeas. Like, and it's just kind of listening to your body because again, there is a lot of noise out there, but I think that's kind of what I think. I think it's so nuanced. There's obviously so many things, how people eat, where people shop, everything like that. But it is really hard. Tommy, do you still follow like a vegan diet, or are you like?
Yeah, I've been vegan for 5 years, and it's really interesting because when you brought up this notion of shaming each other about the kinds of food that we eat, there are a lot of people within the vegan world who are activists and who actively do that, and it's something that I think kind of, you know, disingratiates us in terms of what we're doing, because there are various reasons to be vegan. Some people do it for their health, for their heart health. Some people do it for the environment. Some people do it for animal rights. And some people do it for all three things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always been the type of vegan who, you know, I just do it. I just do me. I do my own thing. I do it for myself. Whatever ethics are attached to it, I don't talk about it unless I'm directly asked the questions. And yeah. It's funny because when you're asked, if you give an honest answer, then people blame you for giving the answer. But I never shame people for having a diet or eating in a different way than I do. I believe that everybody needs to come to their own conclusions about food and what works for them. I do believe that whether I, you know, espouse the kind of diet that I have or not, the world is going more plant-based because we have to. It's hard to feed China with, you know, chickens and cows because we don't have the resources. There isn't the water. There isn't the land.
And if you consider, if you're eating meat, which again, totally cool, that animal also now needs to eat food that could have not gone through that chain. So there is, like, again, there's reasons why it is more.
If yeah. you think people can come to their own conclusions. Like, I don't need, it's not my job to tell people all of that information. There are plenty of people doing a great job of that. It's not for
But
me.
You know, if you'd said plant-based to my parents, you know, it would have been horrifying because, I mean, my mother would kill a green bean. She'd put the on a Sunday roast, the green beans went in 2 hours before the roast chicken. You know, there was no nutrients left in. And you know, as many fruits on the market today that I was in my 20s before I saw.
Yeah, I never saw a kiwi until I was probably 8 years old.
Avocados were like not really like it was like an avocado pear.
Yeah, I had my first avocado in like California when I was 15. Like, we didn't buy them in our household. And, you know, my mother, a couple of years ago when my sister was making a kale salad, my mother looked at me and she said, "Darling, what is kale?" And I was like, well, it's what they used to feed horses. And now we eat it because it's filled with nutrients and things. And she was like, "I know, but like, it seems like your sister's having to like do it. Why is she massaging it?"
She loves that kale.
It wasn't in her wheelhouse. It wasn't in her Rolodex of understanding of what food is. She thought it was horse feed.
You know, in the old days, you know, vegetables were kind of boring, really. And then now, because of great chefs and because of the cooking shows.
Like Mary's.
All kinds of, you know, and vegetables, they're playing with all the different types and morphing them and doing different, and there's different colors and vibrancy. And so vegetables have become just as important as somebody playing with a piece of foie gras or something. I mean, that is the, it can be the base of many things. And I think the wonder of a veganism is the fact that it's made people reinvent food a bit, you know. So how then, because I'm always kind of testing Tommy, you know, so then, so what is the base then of that cheesecake? It can't be, you know, it's cashew nuts. And, then. So what's the, you know, how did you make the gravy then if you didn't use milk? You know, so, you know, so it's there's a lot of experimental stuff going on, which is really good. What I'd love to see for the future is to stop making the label of what somebody is more important than actually what we consume, because everybody's, I'm a this, I'm non-gluten, I'm this.
And that goes to what Mary was saying about the shaming. Exactly. You know, we don't need to be doing that for each other.
If we just said, okay, what is the best food me and my family consume that I can afford now? You know, so, I mean, I saw a vegan apple the other day and it's like, oh, for crying outside, maybe worded a bit kinder. Do you know that rice has no gluten in it? You know, so I think it's very much education, wanting to do it, and then seeing how you can bulk up some days in the week, especially if you're working and stuff and, you know, rice and beans and things like that, and having it in the fridge so that you can reinvent those little dishes every evening, thinking, oh, I'll put some olive oil on and I'll fry it up with, you know, some red peppers or something. Or tomorrow I'll put those chickpeas that are sitting there into a salad. So it's about thinking about the food more and saying, okay, it doesn't make a difference what I am. That's my personal decision or medical decision. There's nothing, as Tommy says, it's nothing to do with anybody else. But you can be an unhealthy vegan, you can be an unhealthy vegetarian, and trying to understand the food companies who are there for one reason only, and that's to make money. So you have to get around that and say, okay, what is good and what is bad? You have to hear my olive oil talk, Mary. I mean,
you have to find the good stuff.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. I was going to say, I went to Italy this past like winter, like January, February with my husband.
And you didn't come and see us.
I know. I was in Pontesiene, which is like just outside of Florence, two stops on the train.
North.
We stayed on like a hill.
Then I know exactly where you were.
right now. LOL. Yeah.
You were on the hill in Tuscany. I know it. Oh my God, that place is amazing.
It was amazing though, going to the markets, obviously, but even just going to the normal grocery store, like going to like the Coop that was in town and just seeing how different those grocery stores are laid out to North American grocery stores and things like that. Yeah. And the amount of, can't even imagine how much inspiration you get just being around food production, like living on an olive farm.
But also it's how quickly your body changes. So we do weekly retreats. We take a photograph of everybody at the beginning of the week and at the end of the week. They look like they've had plastic surgery. They are laughing, they're giggling, they look good, their skin is shining. And it's because A, they put their phones away, they're chatting day in, like Tommy's walking around like my head hurts. They talk non-stop and they're eating fresh local food. It's that simple. You can bring that home.
One final thing before we sign off. Mary, the book is in Mary's kitchen.
Yes.
What is the one thing, the one recipe that we need to buy this book for? Pick one.
Oh, I'm going to give I'm going to open it up. This is for Debbie, my girl, Debbie Travis. It is my lemon cornmeal olive oil cake.
Ooh.
And it's got...
Oh, I'm going to make that.
But it's got lemon curd in it. I feel like it's both British.
You know I'm a lemon curd fiend. Fiend. I love lemon curd.
And then it's a ricotta whipped cream on top. My. This little baby.
Ooh.
Dream.
Okay, I'm doing that.
Okay, that's it. Mary Berg, I'm so proud of you. I love you so much. Thank you for being with us. This has been an amazing conversation. We went way over time. We knew that we would. Thank you.
It's what happened. Thank you so, so much.
Good luck, Mary, with everything. Everybody will love you. Don't worry. Just be you.
Thank you so much. I love you both. Thank you.
Find the Trust Me podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, review, leave us a voice note at thetrustmepod.com or at thetrustmepod on Instagram.
I'm Sarah Burke, and I host the Women in Media podcast, where I'm exploring the challenges women face in the media spotlight and celebrating our triumphs. My guests come from radio, TV, news, and sports, and we'll cover topics like leadership, diversity, stereotypes, and more. Most of all, I'm looking to build a community through a space where we can discuss anything. The Women in Media podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or at womeninmedia.ca. This podcast is distributed by the Women in Media Podcast Network. Find out more at womeninmedia.network.